Hello, everybody. This is TFT, the Frustrated Teacher. Can you hear me? Over my new tunes? Thought I would start off the show with a weird one. So there you have the new weird opening tune, which I'm going to stop now. All right, everybody. Welcome to the TFT Radio Show. Today we are interviewing Michael Butts, who, well, I'm going to let Mike tell you who he is. But Mike and I met on the Students First Facebook page, and for over a year now, we've been, well, let me see if I can characterize this correctly, accurately. And Mike, by the way, you are not muted.
Very good. Now correct it. You're wrong.
We met in sort of, I call them the Edu Wars, where folks on sort of two sides of the issue engage in battle. And the two sides of the issue, well, the issue is education reform, and the two sides are sort of the Students First Michelle Reese side, which, to Mike's credit, is not fully his side. I think he used to be more fully on their side, but he has moved a bit. He has moved a bit. I am definitely against that woman and not on that side, and I rail against that side, and Mike is one of the few people who have put up with me and engaged with me, and I think it's been incredibly productive, and I've been begging him to come on the show for a long, long time. And I was finally able to persuade him to do so. I bribed him with music.
And it worked.
And it was killer stuff, too.
So
on that note, Mike, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for doing this. You'll be glad you did. Why don't you just let folks know a little bit about who you are, and then we'll get into it. And I can tell you right now, there are two callers. One caller waiting in the wings, and give us 10, 15 minutes, caller, if you're holding to be let in live, and we'll let you in a little bit. So, Mike, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, TFT. It's I'm kind of half in disbelief that this is actually happening, but I'm thrilled that it is. It's been a long honeymoon until we can finally get on the show together, and I'm glad to be here. So thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Well, so just very briefly, my bio is on your site there, but essentially, first of all, I consider myself a dad. I'm married, happily married. I've got a second grader in the Chicago public school system, and that's how I primarily identify myself. In terms of professional, I have been working in the healthcare quality improvement and compliance field for about 7 years now. Prior to that, I worked in biomedical research in a couple laboratories. But essentially, my forte and my skill set is in healthcare quality improvement, patient safety and satisfaction, and compliance. So I have that background. I became interested in education reform and just really education in general, probably at a time when a lot of people do and become new to it when their kids first start school, and that's what happened with me. And just had an interest in it and sort of led down a path, and it's definitely exposed a side of me. I'm definitely a Democrat in pretty much all ways, but in some factors of this, I guess you'd have to say I align with the right side. So it's been interesting for me too to kind of flesh out my thinking on things. But I think that's enough. That's enough about me. I can answer any questions about that, but yeah, that's a short
file. Okay. So you're really coming to this, like you said, from a parent's perspective. And let me just, most people know, obviously, by my name, the Frustrated Teacher. I'm a teacher. I'm a former teacher. I'm not in the classroom anymore. But that's where I'm coming from. So just tell me and the listeners a little bit about, you know, your kid started school a couple of years ago, and I'm assuming that it wasn't just the fact that you were going to a public school. You must have been hearing things about reform. I'm just curious, as a parent, how did you find out about this stuff?
Well, I'm an avid.
And oh, hey, Mike, be really good with your phone. Someone says you sound a little fuzzy.
Okay, all right. I will try and talk. I'm also talking on a headphone, which, if it continues, I will switch back.
You sound much better suddenly. That's good.
Okay, I'm holding it up to my mouth. I should have done that from the beginning. You see, I'm already learning stuff. How did I come into it? Well, yeah,
I
went away again. How's that?
That's perfect.
Okay, sorry. I guess I came to it basically from, one, having a kid entering school. We were happy with the school he got into, and we're very happy with the school, and remain happy 2.5 years later. But I'm an avid consumer of news. I read a lot of newspapers and all kinds of magazines and stuff, probably more than I should. And I absolutely was aware of, you know, it's been in the media for a number of years now. I'd say, 3 or 4 years, it's become kind of a hot topic. And I noticed it, and that combined with my son starting school piqued my curiosity and my interest.
I see. And was there any, excuse me, was there anything in particular that piqued your interest? Did you have a concern? Did you see anything going on in your school? You know, anything in particular?
Right. I live in Chicago. I've been here now for amazingly enough, almost going on 20 years. And for anyone that knows Chicago, you know that we've got, you know, just a little problem with corruption and, you know, things like that. It's not unmanageable, but, you know, obviously.
Corruption in the schools?
No, corruption in the city. So
really? Wait a minute. Wait, there's corruption in Chicago? That was a joke, Mike.
I know, and I was. You know what? I'm gonna switch off of the thing and put it to my ear. Hang on a sec.
Okay, yeah, no problem. I don't know if the person in the chat room with area code 561, but who is that?
It was my wife came in, who's listening in the other room, and told me I sound it's hard to hear. So she tells me something, I'll believe it right off the bat.
That is probably a good move.
So at any rate, you know, there's a lot in the news here about there's a huge amount of pension issues in the state of Illinois, and not just with the teachers' pensions, but pretty much every unionized worker has been screwed, for lack of a better term, by, at least as far as I can tell, a combination of union leaders and City Hall and people down in the state capitol promising things that they really knew they couldn't deliver. And that came under the radar at the same time as a lot of school reform issues started happening in Chicago relating to a full school day and things such as that. And it kind of just sort of sparked up in the media here. And my kids started school. And, you know, I've been here for 20 years, so I'm up on Chicago news. And that conflagration of things led me to...
So it sounds kind of like you may have found your way to the ed reform world via the mismanagement of funds, which ties into pensions and unions and that kind of thing. Would that be accurate to say that's sort of how you came to this stuff?
I'd say that's probably that was a big part of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay. And. Teachers, I think, come from a totally different place. And
And
we come from the place that has to do with the kids, and, you know, we sort of don't care about any of that other stuff. Not that we don't care, and I think you and Stu actually have probably said a couple of times that, I know Stu has for sure, about teachers needing to be political and so on, and he actually makes a good point about that. But we sort of we can't, in a sense, because we're stuck doing what's best for kids. And from our perspective, a lot of the stuff that comes down from on high or comes from, you know, ideas that come from the place that you sort of came to this from, mm-hmm. the pension union side, we can't help but say that has nothing to do with kids. That's not a kid problem. That's not an education reform problem. And the reason I say that is because the education reform movement started ostensibly because so many poor kids do badly on the test. So how the union stuff all got involved, you know, that's where I think Dave and all of my side says that it's all convoluted now, and what's being discussed really has nothing to do with the kids and education in schools. It has to do with the business of public school, the politics of public school. You understand?
Well, I think so. Well, you know, I understand, and I think both things are at play here. You definitely have a point there, but I guess we're all suspecting, that both of them are playing a role here. I mean, there's the union side of things, and I mean, when I mentioned pension, I'm not applying that directly to the education issue. That's just what sort of got me interested in to begin with.
Right.
But there's the union side, and there's also the side of, you know, what is right for all kids, but most especially the kids who we already know and have agreed are the most in need of everything we can give them to succeed. So I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think they both play a role, and that's definitely something that we constantly go back and forth in, and people, you know, sling arrows on either side. Well, you know, is that really for the kids, or is that really for the grown-ups? You know, we've all heard those phrases thrown around a million times in this debate.
Right, we have. And I guess I might as well just ask you a really pointed question at this point. We've got two people waiting, and I'll let them in just a couple minutes. The pointed question is, well, first of all, would you agree that the reform movement exists to deal with the achievement gap? I mean, that's what they say. Do you agree that
Do I agree that it exists in order to deal with that problem?
Yes.
In part, yes. Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Oh, what's the other part? I'm not aware of another part.
Well, no, I'd say that's pretty much, that's what it exists. And we're talking about kids that are scoring low,
right.
And are having, you know, all the other issues that they deal with in their lives.
Right.
Those are the ones that we need to target. I agree.
Right. And many of the policies that Michelle is pushing are policies that have to do with, you know, LIFO and tenure and union stuff. And There's just no research that shows that changing any of that does anything for kids. That's all the politics. That's all the money side and everything. Isn't that so? I mean, there just is no research that shows ending LIFO and tenure helps anybody.
Well, there is some research that that suggests and I don't know if I want to say it's a cause and effect link. In fact, I'm not going to say that it is. And I certainly, as you know, I was a scientist in my former life, and I know that correlation and causation do not necessarily equal each other and frequently don't equal each other. But there is research that suggests that LIFO can be more harmful to lower SES schools, socioeconomic status schools. But as we've talked about, you and I and other folks as well, I realize those aren't peer-reviewed, they're position papers. So to answer your question, no, there's not a whole lot of research that suggests that removing it would be good. There's not any that suggests that keeping it would be good.
That's where I'm going to differ with you. First of all, of research on teacher quality, the research shows that veteran teachers, on average, do better.
Great.
And newbies tend to take 2, 3, 4 years to get really good.
In general, I agree with that.
Well, yeah, in general, in the aggregate. We also know that union states have better outcomes than non-union states. In other words, of the actual research, not white papers, not think tank publications, but actual research where they took data and looked at it.
Mm-hmm.
And the only data out there says that veterans are better, and LIFO exists to see to it that veterans remain when school districts don't have the money they thought they were going to have to pay their teachers, and they have to then lay them off. So I cannot let it go. I can't allow you to say there's some research out there that shows the opposite of that. No, there's not. And if there is, it's wrong, because the actual research, the research done with data, shows, and it's common sense, Mike. Of course.
Okay. I agree. There is a common sense component to it. I've never disputed that, and I think that is true in virtually any industry or endeavor that I can imagine. A person who's been doing it for longer would, in general, be more proficient at it than a person who has just begun, in general.
Right.
Totally agree.
Right. Okay.
But I think you're making what I consider is a pretty substantial leap from saying, one, it's common sense, which we agree it is, and two, that there's research that shows that veteran teachers are better at teaching, at their craft, than at their profession, than new teachers are. So those are essentially the same thing. So the research backs up common sense. What the issue, the issue is for me, and if I can speak for other like-minded folk, is that I just don't know if it's a good idea to be making decisions that have several impacts, hiring and firing decisions, and layoff decisions in particular, since we're talking about LIFO. Which is, for those who may not know, last in, first out. I think there may be some listeners who aren't as up on ed policy as the rest of us are. So that's what that
means. Let me just take a quick minute and describe it in just a little more detail.
That'd be great.
Okay, last in, first out is a policy that many, many industries use when faced with budget cuts not of their own making. School districts get state money. School districts put their budget together before they know if they're going to get the state money. When they are not sure if they're going to get that state money by March 15th, which happens to be my birthday, they send out the pink slips to the newest teachers, the first ones, the last ones hired. The new teachers get pink slips. Before they're actually laid off, the state usually sends in its budget, and most of the time school districts lay off far fewer than they had pink slipped. So the only reason LIFO exists is when a school district finds that they don't have the money they were promised by the state, and they then have to cut. And the only way you can cut the kind of money that needs to be cut is by firing teachers, because they're the big expense in a school. So that's LIFO.
Yes,
go ahead, Mike.
Very good. You explained it better than I would have. But yes, that not surprisingly. That's it. So, you know, back to the what we were just before the definition. I think that you're making a potentially dangerous leap in saying that, yes, it's common sense. Yes, there's research to back up common sense that we all believe. But is it enough? Do we believe in it and trust it enough that we're willing to remove a teacher from the classroom?
Because I know what you're getting at.
Let me finish. But other listeners may not.
No,
you know, is it enough
Dave
to remove a teacher from the classroom?
No, let me ask you this.
Based just on common sense and, you know, assumption.
Okay. Common sense tells us it makes sense. The studies, data indicates it makes sense. There's nothing except your concern that for some reason maybe we shouldn't believe all the proof. And that is what drives me crazy with you. What are you waiting for? What more do you need besides actual data and words from people in the industry telling you this? They all tell you this. Nobody has told you anything different. So why? What are you waiting for?
No, that's not true. Lots of people have different things to say about it, including this one.
Well,
so
no,
I mean
the guys on my side. So what are you waiting for? And
well,
call,
of course, like,
I'm not surprised
the guys on your side are saying the same thing. I would expect that. I hope that's true.
What are you waiting for? What are you holding out for? What proof do you need?
Well, let me ask you this. You are very confident that brand new teachers perform less effectively than veteran teachers. I'm assuming that I can make that statement and it's true, correct?
Well that is substantiated by data. That is true. That is a
okay,
fact.
Okay. No, I agree. Fine.
So it's not that I believe
you have confidence in it.
Well, it's a
fact.
Well,
I'm asking if you have confidence in it.
It's not a matter of confidence. It's a truth. The sun, the sun is 93 million miles away, and veteran teachers are better.
Okay, oh, that's fine. I'll posit that it's a truth.
Well, it is.
And
a truth.
What is it? I'll posit that it's a truth.
Okay.
So what if assuming that it is definitely true, and I'll throw a percentage out there. Let's say 99% of the time, it's the right call to make. What is it that you and your side, I mean, I hate to use the word side, but let's just do that for lack of finding some other more comfortable sounding word.
No, okay.
What is it that you are so afraid of that there would be some sort of component, and I'm not reforming it, and I'm not saying it has to be a standardized test score, but some sort of component that demonstrates the teacher's effectiveness?
If you're so sure
that the new ones are the worst, that would back it up, would it not?
I'll tell you what I'm afraid of.
And then we'd be sure.
I'll tell you what I'm afraid of. You want to hear it?
Okay. Yes.
I'm afraid that the reform this is going to take a minute. The reform movement is corporate based. The reform movement is based on the right. The whole reform movement is an attempt to privatize public education. Removing LIFO, removing union protection, allows districts to be bought by CMOs or not, but it allows the broad superintendents that are going to be placed in every district pretty soon to, when LIFO or when a budget crisis kicks in, without LIFO, they're going to be able to boot the veterans, and there goes your institutional memory. They're going to hire, teach for a while folks that commit to 2 years and then are gone, and we are going to end up with a transitory, temporary, young, newbie teaching force. And let's remember Wendy Kopp, who invented this nonsense Teach for America. When she found out her kid was getting a newbie, she bitched and moaned and asked for a veteran. And I guarantee
that happens all the time, doesn't it?
Yeah, every parent out there, when they walk in the first day and find out they've got a fresh young teacher, brand new, they're nervous. That is not reassuring, to say the least. So I fear the end, the literal end of public school and teaching as a career. That's what I'm afraid of. I am not afraid of being held to account for the work I do. I am afraid of being held to account for some kid's test score, because we all know that the test scores are meaningless. I mean, the VAM nonsense that has come out lately has just given an awful lot of proof that kids' scores have nothing to do, do not reflect teacher efficacy. The tests were not made to measure teachers.
Right.
So
I definitely want to talk about VAM.
Hold on, because we've got three callers, and I'm going to let one in. Okay, so this is area code 561. Who are you? And you're on the air.
Hi, TFT. This is Diane Hanselman.
Hey.
I don't know if I called the wrong number, but I was listening anyway.
Well, hi there.
Hi, Diane.
Hi. I am calling to ask Michael, why is he sticking with students first when he has to overlook so many blatant flaws, and there are other reasonable pro-student organizations that he could support instead?
You're asking him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Diane, hi. Thanks for,
hi.
I'm glad to have you call in. Well, I guess, Diane, I would ask you, other than my posting on the Facebook, the Students First Facebook threads, which we all do, How is it that I'm such a supporter or a cheerleader of Students First in your perception? I guess I'm not clear on why you think that I'm so. I mean, I challenge Students First all the time, frankly, for a supporter. I don't know too many other supporters that are willing or, you know, feel the need to try and call them out on certain things, and you all know that I've done that on numerous occasions. So I do support a lot of Student First's ideas. I do enjoy being on their Facebook page, but I'm not a contributing member. I do have some serious issues with their organization. And
well,
you did write
for
them.
Mike, you wrote for them. Don't forget.
I did write for them, and that was...
do you regret that?
Gosh. No, I don't regret it at all.
Okay.
I thought what I wrote was, not to toot my own horn, but I thought it was well done. I thought it was fair, and I certainly don't have any regret or shame for the position, my position, that I described in the essay. But that said, I do have issues with Michelle Rhee's group, and I'm not shy about letting people know about that. So I guess to answer your question, Diane, is I don't know that I'm not as big of a supporter of Students First as you may think that I am.
Here's why I think that you are, Michael, because number one, you are certainly aware that you taped a class full of mouths and that slides by. You are certainly aware there was massive cheating going on for years, and she also knew it and did minimal actions in response to it, accepted the role of Superman in a movie, knowing what really has made her, got her her name up in lights, where she ignores research and acts like poverty has no effect in the classroom, which is in contrast to mountains of literature. And there are, I suggested other places for you to look. You like fear tests. This is what's so frustrating. You're not stupid. No one would say you're stupid. I don't understand.
Oh, I appreciate
why
that.
You overlook things and stick with a politically motivated, corporate-backed privatization movement.
Okay, can you answer all that?
Well, I was just going to say, I should have brought a pencil in here. No, I want to answer all that. First thing is about the mouth taping. I obviously do not condone anything like that ever happening. I think that, first of all, I don't know what actually happened in the classroom. I think it's fair to say that there's enough evidence to say that she did it. I think she's admitted it.
She told the story. I've got audio of it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're right. And in fact, now I'm sure that I've actually probably heard of her at least said it.
Yeah, she laughs about it. She makes a joke.
No,
out of
look,
it.
I'm not standing up here to
look,
judge
what would you
or
have done? What,
anyone's
what are you,
character.
What are you going to do when your teacher tapes your kid's mouth? You going to laugh?
No one is excusing that. But that one incident from one person, whether she's the leader of Students First or she's just some random teacher in the middle of nowhere, is wrong. But it is not a reason to discredit the entire movement. Now, I know you guys disagree with the movement, and that's certainly fine.
You're an advocate for students.
But this movement is going on through many different organizations, Diane, not just Michelle Rhee.
Right, but I think Diane's point, and it's my point too, is if Michelle Rhee is the type of person who was so inept that she thought it would be cute to tape the mouths of her kids... and this is also a woman, mind you, who does not raise her own children. She has made a choice. Now, I get flack for this, but I'm sorry. This woman has married a guy, Kevin Johnson, former basketball player, mayor of Sacramento, who paid out a settlement for a sexual harassment case because he sexually harassed a young girl. She married him and is letting her ex-husband raise the kids. She refuses to raise her own children. And this woman thinks she knows what's good for kids, and you're going to listen to her? Those things alone are reason to hold this woman in contempt, in my mind.
Okay. Hold her in contempt. I'm not telling you not to.
I know, but why don't you?
Then I,
they are true.
You know,
why
she may not
you?
Be the greatest mother. She may be a bad mom. She may be a lousy teacher. Fine. But I think you guys are holding her up. You guys are giving her almost mythical powers.
She has mythical powers. She has a billion, Mike, she's got $1 billion of mythical power. She is.
Lots of organizations have millions and millions of dollars, right?
But they're They're not trying to ruin public education. There's five guys, five billionaires
funding. Not trying to ruin public education is not something. That is not a statement of fact. That is a statement of your opinion and your perception of the.
No, it's we're watching
that are being pushed.
Mike, we're watching it happen. We're watching.
Rich, come on.
We're not watching it happen. You're not watching the narrowing of curriculum. You're not watching the removal of recess, PE, art, and music. You're not watching any of these things happen.
Not where
You're
I
not...
live, I'm not. I'm watching it being added back in.
Well, it's happening all over the place. Maybe not in your magnet school, but it is
it's
happening.
It's not happening in the third largest district in the U.S., so that's
but
Chicago.
It's happening.
And
it's
the
happening.
Exact opposite is happening here. In fact,
it's
a lot of good things are happening here.
But it's happening in the first and second largest school districts in the world. You're next.
Okay, and is your... No, we're not next, because this is actually brand new. It's just sort of started. Thanks to... Well, we can discuss that later as well. I'm happy to talk about that Chicago-specific stuff. But, again, Michelle Rhee is who she is. I don't know her. You don't know her. We know what we read in the paper, and we all know, because we're educated adults who've lived in this country and in this media environment our entire lives, that... what you read is not always the truth. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But whatever she did,
but what is
me, is
wait,
not
wait, wait,
a way.
Wait,
that is
no.
not. Well, just
no.
let me finish. That is
no,
not a reason to say that all of these policies are wrong.
You can't suggest that some of these actual facts might not be facts. Is that your defense, that you don't believe that Kevin Johnson paid out a settlement, and you don't believe that she doesn't raise
her
kids?
I'm not trying to defend her at all.
No, you're
I'm
suggesting
not
that those
defending
things,
Michelle Rhee.
It sounds like you're suggesting that those things might not be true.
As far as I know, they're true. I don't have any reason to think that they're not.
Okay. All right.
Does that change anything?
No, I just want a clarification, because that's the basis of your defense. You're saying that, that we don't believe... You're saying that there's a lot of stuff written that may or may not be true, and that's why, I don't know, because you say it is true. So you're confusing
well,
me.
Well, no, I did say that, but then let me clarify. I want to make sure that the listeners are quite clear on my position. Whatever she did is not a reason to me, personal, Michael Butts, reason to me to say, well, she's kind of a crappy mom. She taped students' mouths, which completely sucks. Therefore, I actually no longer think that teachers should be evaluated for their performance. And therefore, I no longer actually think that
it's
a component of performance when we fire people. I mean, it's just that's just illogical to me.
Well, but
I don't
she's
hold her
making
up as
these,
a saint.
But she's making these claims as someone who is devoted to children. She's saying that these things are necessary because she's devoted to children. But her actions indicate not only is she not devoted to children, she's not even devoted to her own. I'm going to let in another caller because we've got a couple waiting here. Okay, this is area code 206. You're on the air. Who are you, and do you have a question?
Hey there, this is Sahila. Hi, Michael.
Hey!
Hi, Sahila. And that's how I thought it was pronounced. I'm glad I was right.
Hey,
nice
Bobby,
to hear
Bobby,
you.
How you doing?
So nice to hear you.
Well, yeah. What else am I going to do on a Wednesday evening? It is a Wednesday, isn't it?
It is.
It is.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of my concerns is I've been spending the last, you know, I've got my own personal stuff going on, and I'm sitting here in limbo, so I do my thing on the web, stirring the pot and what have you. And one of my concerns about this whole mess that is education, I'm going to use the word deform. I posted an article today, a call coming out of Michigan parents, and they are trying to gather up some support from other school parents, public school parents, to get their legislative representatives to stop a bill that is bringing in, is going to take a cap off cyber charters. And right now the cap is, I think they're only allowed something like 30 of them. It's a very, very small number, but they want to take the cap off. And they want to have online cyber schools for kindergartners through to grade 12, with each school have being allowed to have up to 33,000 students with no teachers. And I just don't understand what in any of that is actually education. You know, how can you have a kindergartner in cyber school? I mean, kindergarten for most kids is not so much about learning as it is about social skills and finding their own identity away from their home environment and you know, learning to be with other people and all of that kind of stuff. How can you have kindergarten cyber school? And my concern is that there is no, all of these decisions are being made and being enacted through lobby groups without parental involvement. Legislation is being written by organizations like ALEC. They have templates for these things that just pop up in different states, and these laws get passed without any community input. And I think this country is, it's heading down that track, that same track in many, many different areas where people really don't have any democracy anymore, that their legislators are wooed by lobby groups and they do what ALEC and other organisations want them to do. And this to me is kind of like the last stand. Education is the last stand because democracy is built on education, and that means a good quality education for everybody. And I just see it all going downhill, which is why I fight for this. So, Michael, what would you think about a charter school that has an online charter school that has 33,000 students?
Here's what I would think. First of all, I don't know about the story that you're referencing. My initial reaction to a charter school that's entirely online that has an enrollment of 33,000 students, K through 12, is not particularly positive.
Mm-hmm.
I think we can agree that sounds like, that sounds kind of fantastically ridiculous to me.
Mm-hmm.
33,000 students, I mean, that's a state university.
I know. Do you know that the charters company that provides that gets all of their state funding at around $6,000 per child? Can you imagine the profit in that?
Well, I can imagine the profit, although I don't know, I have no idea what percentage of, what their business plan is like, what the percentage of profits, if
mm-hmm.
any. Not all charter schools are for profit, many of course are not. But to comment on, if I may, on just the technology and the classroom piece, I have two
mm-hmm.
comments, that and then also back to the profit. Well, let's go with profit first since we were talking about that. So, first of all, I fully respect, I really respect all of you guys, whether we agree or we don't, because we're all there. We all care about children. We all care, well, you may dispute this, but I'd say we all care about teachers as well. I know, in fact, I know you'll dispute it, but that's fine. We're all aiming, uh-huh.
We do care about teachers. I agree.
Yeah.
Well, no, I know you do. I know you guys do. I'm certain of that. I meant all, as in sort of all everybody, involved in the state in any way.
Gotcha.
But I think there's something else at play here, Sahila. And did I pronounce it right?
Yeah, you did.
Okay, and that is that you and I have gone back and forth, sometimes heated, sometimes humorous. About what I consider to be just really a great sort of fear, and it's not just you; it's definitely a sentiment present in the country. A fear of profit, a fear of kind of a thinking that business is always evil, and there's always ill intent behind corporate donations or anything such as that, or even the hint of textbook companies making profit. I read that all the time. These these goddamn textbook companies and their profits. And my response to that is, this is how businesses, any business, even trading between two neighbors, operates. There's very little incentive for people to publish a textbook or do the research that would be required to write a really good textbook and publish it if they're not going to make money. Yes, people are altruistic, but essentially it's just not, it doesn't make sense to me to start off with an underlying, I'd almost call it a revolution, again.
Can I butt in?
Any kind of profit.
Quick?
Sure.
I've got something to say too about
okay,
that.
Okay,
well,
I just want to butt in and say that I'm not sure, you know, that you sound, Mike, and I know you're not one, but you sound like a right-winger who has stereotyped us as lefty nutcases who hate everything about money and blah, blah, blah. And that's really not true. You know, I understand that the textbook company needs to make a profit, but they don't need to redo the textbook every couple of years to really make really, really huge profits like they do. And they don't need to be in cahoots with the testing company. Says me, the teacher, who doesn't need an updated text every couple of years.
Okay.
It's not necessary. It has nothing to do with children. Nothing. I don't need the textbooks. I can go to the library. We now have the Google. And Google, I mean, there's a million. I never use the curricular materials in my classroom anyway. I mean, they're constraining. They script you, and it's ridiculous. So, you know, we're not coming from that place. We're coming from the place that is reform, and we see the right, the Kochs, the Murdochs, and their money, and then we see the defer, the folks on the left who are all the neoliberal business-minded folks who think the market, who are basically anti-Keynesians, and that I think is where we're coming from. We're not just loopy, deadhead lefties who want to be in heaven and want heaven here on earth. And
well,
you know,
I wouldn't be so.
I mean, let me be honest. Yes, I do. But
me too.
Realistically, we understand that that's not going to happen. So no, Mike, that's not really. And I'm speaking for Sahila, and she's going to correct me. But no, we're not coming from that place. We're coming from the reform place. Go, Sahila.
What I'm coming from is, my real big concern is that it's all a closed loop with very little outside influence. We now have Pearson writing the curriculum, writing the textbooks, writing the tests, and scoring the tests. Mm-hmm. And then we have all that data made available to Gates and Murdoch to do with what they want. There's no input from anybody else about what should be in the curriculum, what books. They're narrowing down the range of books, for example, that you can use in, I think you call it language arts here, English
yes.
literature, for example.
Mm-hmm.
They're narrowing down what, they're even taking fiction out of the curriculum and having various kinds of
non-fiction.
Who's
they, if I may interject?
This is Pearson.
Oh, okay, the company, okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a big discussion on it right now about some of the things that are coming out of Pearson's into the next batch of curriculum and textbooks, and they're not having fiction in them anymore. Children, as far as they're concerned, children don't have to read fiction novels or whatever in class anymore. That's something that you do in your own time, and the kind of English that they're trying to teach children is, you know, technocrat speak, basically. And from my point of view, this closed loop where one company or one entity or half a dozen entities that are connected together control the entire system and then suck all the money and keep all the money out of that for themselves, that's an issue. I see that to me is not education, and it's not public education. It's controlled by private companies now.
Well, whatever, and you guys will have to tell me, because I, you know, I'm ignorant on this fact. Was there a time when, I'm assuming that there was a time at some point in the past when you felt differently about how textbooks were researched and published. Is that true?
Meaning now
it's become more narrow and...
Yeah.
Yeah, they used to... Go ahead, Celia. I'm sorry.
No, you go. This is more your area of expertise. I know what happens in Australia and New Zealand for that area.
Yeah, you know, the big problem with textbooks in America is that they are published based on the largest markets. So you get textbooks that are overly general, lack specificity because they need to cover California, Florida, and New York. And because of that, they're limiting, just because of that. And that's been that way for a long, long time. Now, since we're rewriting curriculums and passing laws that require states to make all kinds of changes, sometimes curricular changes and standards changes, the textbooks companies are now, in the money because they have to rewrite everything. Of course, they don't have to. No kid and no teacher needs them to, but they need to because they got what they wanted, re-pushed these laws and got certain states to change these laws, big important states like Florida and California, and they're going to make millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars doing absolutely nothing for anybody except themselves.
And the point is that this is money that's coming straight out of classrooms.
Right.
And that's my big chunk. You know, that this money is better spent in classrooms with kids and teachers than it is going into the back pockets of textbook companies.
Well, was there a time when, I mean, are textbooks now much more expensive than they used to be? I mean, school districts have always had to purchase textbooks, no?
They have to do it more frequently now.
There's constantly a new adoption.
There aren't issues in, you know,
Wait, one last thing about this, because this is kind of important. When a school does not meet its AYP, its average yearly progress based on the NCLB law, they're up for sanctions. One of the sanctions, oftentimes, is purchase a new curriculum.
Meaning they're compelled to purchase a new curriculum?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we all agree, and it's becoming more and more clear that, nationwide, that NCLB had very good intent, but was not designed in a way that is feasible long-term. So I'm not surprised,
Time out. Ladies and gentlemen, Stuart Roden, are you on the air?
Hello?
Stu?
No.
Who's 312?
Oh, this is Gregory Noggle.
Oh, well, you're on the air now, Gregory.
Oh, my goodness, I am.
Where is 312?
312 is also Chicago.
Ah, okay. All right. Are you a friend of Mike?
I am not.
All right. Good to have you with us.
But I am. I've been a passive follower of the Students First blog, and I've seen your and Mike's interactions, and they've been humorous at times, but always enlightening.
Okay. Good.
I agree.
Do you have a question or anything, or do you want me to mute you?
No. Well, I do have a question. It's about the textbook issue, and I hadn't considered this before. But I guess, what's the proposal? Let me ask this first. I mean, charter schools, for example, if there's such a revolt against the nature of textbooks companies, if they are sort of monopolizing education in print form, if you will, then... Wow, aren't charter schools a great alternative where you can set the agenda a little bit better?
Well,
no.
You want me to respond to that? My response.
Yeah, let me add real quick. You know, I lived in Russia for a long time, and I'm a student of Russian history. I mean, you know, I can't think of anything worse than depending on sort of a monolithic industry to provide you your knowledge. So, I mean, it sounds like you guys are
on that page. No, it's not.
What about charter schools where you can set your own agenda?
I'm not
being facetious. I'm asking because it just sprung into my mind.
All right. I'll give you an answer.
Your question.
Here's the answer. First of all, the education system in America is not monolithic. They're run by elected boards in each small.
I think he's talking about the.
I know. I'm going to get to it. They're elected. Okay. They're elected by the people in the town. So a little town like Berkeley has its school district, and they're basically in charge. Of course, they have to follow state standards, and they have to follow whatever federal standards come down. But for the most part, they're free to sort of tailor the needs, tailor their school to the needs of their community. Once we start allowing charters and we start allowing people to leave the traditional public schools for the charter, and I should preface this by saying there really is no... All the scores, once they come, we can always show that charters are no better, really, than public schools, on average. Now, the good... Hold on
average,
the,
but there are definitely studies written that show
I'm
that
getting,
they are.
No, there aren't.
There are.
No, I'm getting to it. I told you, this is a long explanation, because it's complicated. Charter schools cream their students. Only parents and kids that care enough to even seek out a charter school are going to go. So right there, you've got a self-selecting population, which means that their socioeconomic status is higher than for those that would not have the wherewithal to even know there's a charter out there to choose. Second thing is, if you look at the scores of charter schools and our affluent schools almost always outperform everybody. Charter schools, the affluent ones, they also outperform. But our poverty schools, whether they be charter or traditional, don't do well.
I disagree on some level, but I do
feel
what you're saying
about
charter schools.
What do you disagree on?
But,
Hold on, Gregory. I put you on hold. You said you disagree, and I want to know exactly what you disagree with, because what I just told you were facts.
Well, I'll tell you one from empirical evidence. I volunteered at a charter school here in Chicago, and there's 100% college acceptance rate in the last two classes that I've mentored. And socioeconomically speaking, these kids are on the same par as of a sampling of the public school system.
What is?
Well,
let me ask you.
So you're right, TFT. I mean.
Hold on. I think you just made a mistake. I think you just said that they're socioeconomically something or other. Do you think socioeconomic status has to do with money?
It does in large part.
No, it doesn't in large part. I mean, money.
Of course it does.
I'll explain it to you guys if you want me to. Socioeconomic status is a multiple measure. It is not a measure of wealth. Yes, wealth is one aspect of it, but the primary measure used in sociology and education when using the term socioeconomic status is almost exclusively the education of the parents that we're talking about. So when you want to talk about socioeconomic status as having to do with money, that is incomplete and therefore false. So you're telling
me...
So what you're telling me is that there's poor kids in that charter school. What you are not telling me, and what you may not know, is that those poor kids had parents concerned enough to seek out a charter school. So what you do with charter schools, with the charter movement, is you suck the brains from the traditional public schools and you make a two-tiered system. You leave the traditional public schools for the people that don't give a shit, and only people that care can maybe... And only maybe, because there's a lottery, get in to a public school, Anthony.
The question I'd
Gregory.
Like to ask of, of the 100 Gregory here, yeah. The question that I'd like to ask about the 100% that are go on to college is how many people, how much attrition has there been before you get to what is it, year 12, 12th grade? How much attrition
has
there been before
to be
you get there? Yeah, so 100%.
Well, there's. I can partially answer that.
But if you lost 100 kids along the way, then it's not 100% off to college, is it?
No, that's a good point.
Time out. Was that Mike trying to answer?
That's me. Yeah. Let me just say something.
Sorry.
There's a number of studies, I mean, one of which I can, I think it was a Mathematica study of KIPP schools, that, and what they found is there's no evidence that at least the KIPP schools that were studied, I think they studied 25 or some number of schools, there were not significantly higher levels of attrition when they compared them to the district schools. And I guess I don't know, let's say that there is a higher attrition rate. The lines of parents who are waiting desperately to get their kid into one of these schools are stretching around the hypothetical block.
Should we deny these parents?
Should we say, because you care more than some of the other parents in your school, fuck you. You're not going back.
No.
You're going to stay where you are.
I don't advocate
for that at all.
I would much prefer
that we put our focus and our money, instead of splitting our money and leaving public schools with less than they had before, I would rather that we, you know, I've written this so many times. I want to say to Obama and Bill Gates, you know, why can't all the kids in this country have what you give your children? You know, do you want to put your kids in a public school? Obviously they don't. So what is so special about their kids that they get this guilt-laden road to their future, and everybody else's kids have to fight over the scraps? And so why are
so you are you saying that because rich politicians and business leaders put their kids in private school, that's the reason that all the other poor American public school students are the way they are?
Let me try.
Okay.
What we're saying is that once you split apart our public school system into a two-tiered system like we have with
Well, except the charters are a minuscule part of it.
No, they're not. Then let me explain
why. What percentage of American students are in a charter?
In Oakland, 30. Don't tell me that just because you're taking a national number and trying to figure out the average in charter schools and that number is small, that it's a meaningless number, because in some large towns, it's upwards of 30-something percent of kids.
Or more in New Orleans.
So that's just a nonsense. I don't know what point you're trying to make with that. But the point of the fact that you know less than 10% of kids are in charter schools nationally means nothing when upwards of 30 to 50 to 90% of kids are in charter schools in Oakland, L.A. and New Orleans. So for those cities, there is no other option.
Well, I guess there's an option for the other 70%.
Okay. Yeah. Is that? But you don't. You sound dubious about that.
You're the one who just told me 30% of Oakland students are in charters, and that's
right.
The only option. I'm just saying for the other seven out of those
ten,
their option is public school.
The option of the national figure says 10% in Oakland. They don't have 90% traditional schools to choose from. Their options are limited compared to the national figure you're giving us. So that's why I'm saying it's kind of irrelevant, because it's very different depending on the city you're in. But the point is that if you create a two-tiered system, if you create two systems of schools, you suck money from each because we don't fund education properly anyway. And what you end up doing is you end up segregating kids by socioeconomic status. There is data out there that is showing that this is indeed happening. And so
And there's data that shows that it isn't. There's a 2009 study out of Vanderbilt that looked at charter schools in Chicago, Milwaukee, Philly, Texas, a bunch of places. The findings of that study, they did not cream. They did not tend to increase segregation.
Well, then that study
that
is
students
bogus.
Moving from traditional public school to charter were moving between schools with similar racial profiles. The only thing they did find is that there is evidence that African-American students may move to a school with a higher percentage of African American students.
So that's one study.
I'm not going to say that's the law.
Well, there's the Hawksbee and the Hanischek, and they started to argue over how kids were counted, and people like Gideon Stein and people on the reform side like to claim that it was similar schools or similar students were were measured, but indeed they weren't. There's a problem.
Says who?
There's a big problem. Says Diane Ravitch, Matthew DiCarlo, Ellen, what's her name, from the Shanker Institute, Michael Martyr of UTeach and Texas, who's going to be on the show at some point.
The outlier.
Yeah, that guy. So there's a whole bunch of actual scientists, statisticians that have said that those studies, that study in particular, is just not to be trusted. But then there's also the case that we have we've talked to people whose kids have been counseled out. We talked another thing that charters don't do. These aren't anecdotes though. In Oakland, it happened a lot, and Gideon Stein had to admit to me that Oakland has a problem. Of course, he wouldn't come out and say that. And so how many other districts have a problem with KIPP? The KIPP guys are not going to tell you. And when the actual student and his mom who got booted do tell you, you just claim it's an anecdote. So here's the problem.
Nobody told me. You told them.
Well, I'm telling you, and there's that big one that's been going on, the Success Academy, that Bronx had on his show and did a blog post about, and it's now blowing up in Gideon's face again. The charter movement has created a shadow system of schools that is sucking the brains, like I said, sucking the concerned families out of the traditional public schools. What we need to do is pour our money into public schools, because charter schools don't offer anything different. They claim they do, and if you listen to my interview with Gideon, I asked him all the differences. He really couldn't come up with one. The one thing he came up with was they work harder, and then he had to admit that he has no fucking idea if they work harder, and in fact they probably
don't.
Yeah,
you pressed him on that. Yeah, I listened to that.
Yeah, and it's just nonsense. They don't do anything except get young teachers who don't know what they're doing, who then leave, and they cream a bunch of students. And the ones that don't do well, they boot. That's how they get. And even with all that nonsense, they still are, on average, no better than traditional public schools. Why? Because common sense tells you that kids don't learn in a certain room, in a certain desk lineup configuration, with certain pedagogy. Every kid is different. Every teacher is different. Teaching is a relationship between the teacher and the student. These charters and anybody that claims they have the pedagogy is full of shit. And every teacher knows that. And that's why I can say with such confidence that there's not one actual teacher on the reform side.
Well,
so there's that. Okay, we've got a couple of people.
No, I mean, there's obviously a great deal of, which is not a surprise to me, there's a great deal of anger on your side of this thing. That's very evident. That's very evident.
I'm letting you know, people. I've let in.
I respect people getting mad about stuff.
Michael, this is radio business. I'm doing radio business right now.
Radio business.
Can I ask something, Rich? Rich?
Is that you, Anthony Krinsky?
No, I wanted to ask.
Who's talking, Anthony?
Gregory.
Gregory,
are you actually Anthony Krinsky?
No. I don't know
sure?
who that man is.
Are you sure about that?
I'm positive. I swear by God.
Okay.
Well, I'd like to make a comment, but I'll ask a question first because I want to stay on topic. And Rich, my question, I want to go back to the textbook thing. That's actually why I called in, because I found it interesting, the whole textbook debate, which I hadn't considered before. But you mentioned, you know, the textbooks. You said, you know, you don't use them. You said you don't teach to them. Or I don't want to put words in your mouth, but something to that effect.
Yeah.
Isn't that, in essence, in a microcosm, what a charter school is doing? It's not teaching to the system. It's branching out and saying, well, you know, what I am being provided the standards that are being voiced upon me aren't acceptable. So I'm branching out and doing something different.
No. Okay, I'll explain it. Let me explain it again. And the best explanation I have for this, by the way, more radio business. Everybody that called in, everyone is on the air. You're all live, so just shut up.
Okay.
You hear me, Rich?
Great. Oh, good. So, yeah, I hear everybody. So I tell you all to shut up, and what does everybody do? Okay, they all talk.
then I have something to say here, because that is
Krinsky. I know,
Krinsky.
Bronx, but hang on, Bronx. I know, you think it's Krinsky, and he claims it isn't.
It's not, Rich.
Okay, hang on. Just so everyone's on the air. The reason...
I don't want to get into butts.
You know what, dude? Zip it for a minute. Good Lord. So, let me say that Gideon told me that he claims, and he also had to walk it back, that, you know, that his charter schools, the Success Academy, they train their teachers to do blah, 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 and they have a curriculum and a certain way. And I asked him what that was, and he really couldn't come up with it. You know why? Because it's all nonsense.
It's us, man.
Hold on. Because the charter schools are, if you want to call something top down and one size fits all, you got to talk a charter. What the charters claim and what they actually are two very different things, and they've played a trick on you guys. Here's the deal: charter schools claim to be different and to offer different pedagogy and a different, and a longer, and who knows what the fuck they offer, because it's all just bullshit. But they offer it to you, and then you go, oh, my kid needs that, so I'm going to go to that charter school. And then what you find out is that there's absolutely nothing different, really, because a classroom full of second graders is a classroom full of second graders. Okay, I don't care who they are, where they are, and you put a teacher up in front of them, and either that teacher is going to be scripted like they do at the charter schools where they're told exactly how to operate, or you're going to get a teacher up there that is not so scripted. Maybe he works in a district where they allow the teachers some autonomy, like back in the old days when I began. And, you know, that's why I had the highest scores.
Didn't you get in trouble for doing that?
Let me finish. And I had the highest scores in the district 3 years running for little second graders. And if I were to get in trouble, I would be getting in trouble for doing right by my students. Okay, not doing wrong by them. And what the charter schools do is they claim all this crap, and then what happens is they don't deliver. Not only do they not deliver, but they start out an advantage by creaming their students. They continue that advantage by booting low performers and lying about it and claiming they didn't do it. Ask Jeffrey Canada at the Harlem Children's Zone about that. And so they make claims that are demonstrably false, yet the public buys them. You seem to think that sending your kid to a charter means that teacher is free to do whatever they want. That is so far from the truth.
That is,
I don't think it has.
Let me back you up on that, T. It's Eileen.
Hey, can I just
Eileen, go.
Hey. Okay, I have been a charter school teacher for 3 years and a public school teacher for 5 years, and I left the public school thinking maybe I could actually teach at a charter school, and it ended up being much more scripted, much worse. And they're doing a huge disservice to the parents, because they're going out, they're recruiting them, and they're telling them, hey, we're better than where you're at. When, in fact, I'm finding out now, the public schools that most of these kids came from, we're servicing them, we're doing a good job. It's just the communication might not have been there, or they wanted to get their child away from one other kid, or the charter school happened to be in their neighborhood and the kids could walk to it. So a lot of times parents aren't even picking charter schools because it's better, because they don't even know.
Right.
You know, we have no arts programs. It's so regimented. These kids are like, it's almost like torture, because they're given no time to be kids.
Wow.
Well, Eileen, can I ask you, and I it's great to talk to you. What would you tell, you've taught in one, what would you tell, I'm just curious, the parents who are waiting for their shot to get their kid in these schools? To me, honestly, what you guys are saying is kind of, to me, and I don't mean to sound offensive, but I'm just going to say it, it sounds almost like these people don't have, these parents, they've got no clue about anything.
Yep.
They're just running down the block to the nearest school.
Yep.
And
that's what we're saying.
Michael, some.
I'm, I, I
not,
am, I am saying that, dude. I am saying that the charter movement...
I know you are, and I think that is just whack, man.
They're duping people. They are duping. It's bait and switch. It's classic bait and switch. Eileen just told you.
Some of them. You know, they're smaller...
Well, the big ones. The big chains are...
that aren't chains, yes. Yeah.
Right, the little
like Eva,
teacher...
Like Eva Moskowitz.
Yeah, she's a disaster. You know, Canada's those are the liars. The little independent schools that pop up, I have no problem with those. Those are usually...
What are they lying about?
What are the KIPPs and the Aspires lying about? They're lying about their graduation rates. They're lying about their retention rates. They're lying about their scores because they refuse to admit that they cream and boot. They're lying about...
Well, but that doesn't mean they're lying about their scores.
No, it means that, yes, it does mean they're lying about... Just like
ow.
I claim... Well, I'll explain it. Just like when I say that when people claim the NAEP or PISA numbers that were 14th or 17th, and I say that's a lie, I guess technically it's not a lie because they're looking at aggregated numbers as opposed to disaggregated numbers, because the actual truth is, when you look at the NAEP and the PISA, our affluent kids are number one in the world, the fucking world... So that 14th or 17th.
No, Rich,
14th
you did open my eyes to that, and
that's what I'm calling. I'm using that sort of construction by saying when I say that the charters, the big chains, are also lying. They're obfuscating. They're not telling the whole truth. They're giving you a line so you'll want to apply, but they're not telling you the truth about it. They're not telling you that if you don't live up to their standards, you're going to get booted. And it's also the case,
yeah,
and I don't know
okay.
if everybody knows this. One last thing, many of these charters, KIPPs for sure, have severe codes of conduct that not only kids but parents have to comply with, and if they don't, they're gone. So these
and you know what, man? A lot of these kids need that.
But a lot of these kids can't do it, and they get booted. And where do they end up? Back in the traditional public school where we
okay,
know how
all
to
right,
take care
that's
of
fine,
them.
Rich,
so
but what about the kids that benefit from
why
that?
But why have the extra step? Why put a kid into a school where he's going to get booted? I mean, do you know what that feels like to be a child?
I seriously doubt
booted?
That the charter will enroll a child that they already know
really?
Will be booted eventually.
No, but I'm saying whether they know or not, they do enroll these kids and then boot them with no care for how awful it must feel, it seems.
Well, all right, but again, should that mean that all the other students that are not booted should not be allowed to have that opportunity?
Yes, that's exactly what that means. The opportunity.
Well, then we just have an unbelievably strong disagreement.
Can I break in here?
Yes.
Can I break in? I just pulled up a... I was interested in providing some stats and some names for some of this research, and I've just pulled up a paper. I just Googled, I was looking at textbooks, and I came up with a paper called Private Interest in Public Education Reform by Jerry Klobe from the Institute for Community Studies, and it was done early in the 2000s, and there's this thing, I've got to find this thing again, there's a whole bunch of stuff about segregation, about textbook companies, about investment capital seeks growth in privatized schools. Okay, I'm just going to read a very short sentence here. Michigan industrialist J.C. Huizenga, founder and chairman of National Heritage Academies, characterized for-profit education as a breakthrough business opportunity. This was reported in 2003. There's a reference. Huizenga invested more than $50 million in NHA, which started in 1995 with a single charter school and grew to 32 schools in four states, serving more than 17,000 students by 2003. He was named the Entrepreneur of the Year by the Education Industry Association in 2003. So this is the attitude of the education reformers. This is a breakthrough business opportunity.
I didn't hear anything objectionable there.
You didn't?
I mean, how did the students do? How did the students do? How did the students do in those schools?
Wait,
do we know?
Time out.
We don't know.
Time out. One of the problems is that even if they give you their scores, you have no idea what that means. That's what
I was
just explaining
to you.
We have
no idea what it means for any school, Rich.
That's right, Mike. That is exactly
right. Well, okay, but we've all agreed that
you should not
whether you guys like it or not, that is our measuring stick in this country.
body. But it's a wrong measuring stick. It doesn't measure the right thing, and it's being used
it
as a bludgeon.
It may well be, but it is nevertheless the measuring stick. So if we're
so
using
we're
that
trying
to
end it.
Talk
no,
about
no,
public
you,
schools,
you don't
okay,
okay,
okay.
Do you
apply the charter.
Do you want
to go back to the
you
national
say,
measuring
oh, it's
school?
A bad measuring stick, but that's all we have. You say, no, it's a bad measuring stick, and therefore the results are worthless.
Right.
I'm sorry, Diane, I didn't hear the beginning of your question.
Diane
I think
said,
that's Diane.
Diane made a comment.
I tried
Make
to clarify that I believe that you don't say it's a bad measuring stick, but it's the only one we have. You say it's a bad measuring stick, therefore the results are useless.
Okay.
I'm
not necessarily disputing that. Look, you guys have seen my transformation, whatever word you want to say, on VAM, on value-added models, and using those kind of data. You've seen me change my thinking on that. And I think it's changed pretty significantly.
But you're still,
it's changed
you're
from
still
me
willing.
Saying I love the idea, I love VAM and think that it is a good tool to use in degrading a teacher's effectiveness, and it should be a significant component of the evaluation. And that has changed to me basically saying, I no longer think that that is something that we can put stock in, but I believe in the idea of it.
Right.
I think that we can
it,
get there.
But it's being
I know
used,
we're using
right.
it, but the point is that I admit that it is not anywhere close to perfect.
Well,
it
it's
may
more
be
than,
far,
it,
probably as far it, from it. Let's
it's
not
your
argue
own
it. We're all agreeing.
No,
here.
No, no, Mike, hold on. I know we are agreeing, but there's one crucial difference where we don't agree, and that is, we all agree it's useless and can give incredibly wrong impression of a teacher's efficacy, so we're not willing to use it and we're not willing to believe any results from it. You are, it sounds like, even a little bit.
I would like to.
We're not even
no,
okay with it.
No, that's not at all what I just said. It's the exact opposite. I said that I used to think that way until I learned more, and thanks to some of you folks for helping me find out where to get more information about that, that it's true.
I
absolutely agree that it's not valid. However, it is the currently, and let's not talk about teacher evaluations now, because we're going back to Sahila's, the study that she read about whatever it was, making all that money off of the charter schools in Michigan, or I don't remember the state, but... See, now I've lost my train of thought. Oh,
okay.
Exactly. I've caught the train. I'm back on the train. yes, it is a totally imperfect tool, but it is currently the tool that has been accepted as what we use to compare
no, it hasn't.
Schools and districts.
No, it hasn't.
What is?
We don't accept it.
Who's we?
Millions of us. Mostly,
well,
three
okay,
million
but
teachers.
In a country of 300 million people, I'm not surprised there's wildly divergent views on every single possible issue. But
well, three
institution,
million
the powers that be, have accepted that for now. And I'm not talking about teacher evaluations right now. We're just talking about, that's why I asked her after she read that thing and was very seemingly upset that all the money that would be made. That's why my first question was, how are the kids doing? One of my big complaints
that.
Is that everything gets derailed
about
thinking
that.
About who's making money. Okay, let's hear it.
There is more about that. It's a precursor to the Credo report, which you know what the Credo report says. 17%
yes.
of charter schools do better than public schools. Around 30 to 40% do the same, and 40-something percent do worse than. It refers to that, and it calls out a couple of charter school chains and talks about their, frankly, their abysmal results. And it's talking about the Edison. I've got to go back up. Talking about Edison and blah, blah, blah. Perhaps the biggest and most important of these for-profit companies is Edison Schools. Edison was founded in 1992 and now runs 130 schools in 20 states, serving 132,000 students. Edison makes Gerald Bracey, author of The War Against America's Public Schools, says that Edison makes hyperbolic conclusions using data that can only be described as questionable. U.S. Representative Chaka Fatah from the Democrat from Pennsylvania says the overwhelming majority of Edison schools perform poorly, in many cases faring worse than some Philadelphia schools. Gary Myron
our findings suggest that Edison students do not perform as well as Edison claims in its annual reports. So there's this fudging of data that goes on, and you have to sit there and you have to peel through layers of data, like how many kids, you know, this attrition rate thing is a huge issue. You have charter schools claiming that, you know, X percentage of their students go on to college, but they don't tell you how many they've lost.
I agree with you. I agree in principle.
The entry requirements.
I'm not going to say that, you know, every piece of data that comes out of the charter movement is accurate or that I believe. Of course I don't, because I don't believe every piece of data that comes out of anything on any topic.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I don't know about half the time, but some percentage of the time it's either false or it's spun or it is, you know, one way or another, you know, the whole picture isn't told. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm not going to sit here and say that every single charter, no one says this, that every single charter school outperforms the local school. But let's go back to outperforms again. How do we know it outperforms? And I'll agree with you that we may not actually know. But
right.
based on the accepted by the powers that be, our government, our boards of education, based on the currently accepted measuring stick.
That's all we have
to go by right now.
I hear you, Mike. I do hear you, and I kind of even understand where you're coming from. But here's what I have to say about your position on that. Yes, it is what many districts have decided to use, even though it's been shown to be useless.
Just to clarify, I don't interrupt you, but I want to understand and make sure we're talking about the same thing. We're talking about standardized test scores.
Yes, sir.
Correct?
Yep.
Okay, go ahead.
So, and you know, and VAM uses those standardized test scores. And so the standardized test scores are used to judge the kids and then by extension the efficacy of their teachers.
They're much more used to judge kids yet. It hasn't gotten that.
You're right. The score is part of VAM, and one of the arguments that we kept having, and that you before you sort of made the change, was what percentage of VAM should be used, blah blah blah. If the test scores don't really tell you anything, and they don't, this coming from a teacher, I'm telling you, they don't mean a damn thing. Those standardized test scores mean nothing, and this coming from a guy who had really high ones. Okay, they were meaningless. I had a couple geniuses those 3 years in my class. Those test scores are erroneous. They're wrong. They don't measure anything. You can't look at them and glean anything from them. Nothing. Yet you're saying that's what we have to use because that's what's being used. Oftentimes when people make that statement, I always come back with the Bobby Knight, Connie Chung story when Connie was interviewing Bobby Knight, and they were on a basketball court, and he said to her something about, you know, look, if you're getting raped anyway, just lie back and take it because you're not going to be able to beat the guy up. And that's kind of what it sounds like to me, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
You know, since we have this shitty test that means nothing, but the powers that be have decided they're going to fuck you in the ass with it, you ought to just lay back and take it. And worse,
I don't see how you got that from what I said.
No.
I made no comments about that whatsoever.
I don't think that's your conscious attitude. But I'm using this horrible thing to sort of smack you upside the head to get you to see how I see it. Because that's how
I know you used it a few months ago, and I thought it was an inappropriate analogy then, and
yeah,
I still do.
But
that's all right.
Well, but it's not. You're telling me that you're okay using it simply because it is the thing that is used, and I'm saying that if the thing that is used is bad and wrong, then you should not accept it. You should fight it and scream at it and say no, 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 and never give it any credence at all. But you do constantly give it credence by saying that it's what we have to use. It's all we got. No, it's not.
Rich,
teachers...
no, you are mischaracterizing me. You got one part of what I say right, and you got one part that you added in. The part that's right is, it's what we've got. It's what we've got right now. And the part that's wrong is the sentiment of my saying, because it's all we got, let's just use it and don't, you know, let's not worry about
anything else. It exists, and we have it, and, you know, we know what the numbers, you know, are supposed to mean. I'm not saying that at all. I'm talking about reality, and we've discussed this many times, and Sahila, you and I have gone back and forth about this concept too, and I'm saying the reality, the current situation is that these standardized test scores are the number one metric that we use in the United States to judge how well a school or a district or a subsection of
if you would just student population, if you would just throw in the word wrongly, if you would just use the word wrongly when describing that, I could agree with you.
My intent is that the reality is here's what we have. It's what's accepted now. It may be wrong.
It's not accepted.
I think it is wrong.
Okay.
I think there are uses for standardized test scores, but as it currently stands now, we do agree that it is not appropriate to use them in value-added models that are used in hiring and firing decisions of teachers. So that is,
Should it be used at all? We agree on that. Should it be used at all, Mike?
Well, until something else can replace it, I guess I would have to say yes. I mean, can you imagine us being like, let's not do anything for like five years until we develop them, and then we'll start tapping. That's what I don't understand.
That is absolutely what I don't understand. Who?
Rich, come in.
Who are you?
It's Gregory.
Gregory?
Sure, Anthony Krinsky.
Anthony Krinsky.
I am not Anthony Krinsky.
Okay.
But I have no idea who Anthony Krinsky is, but Anthony Krinsky is a guy
that Bronx and Anthony had some nonsense going on. Anthony is a reformer and wants to be a big shot. And I've made a couple comments on his blog and told him he's an idiot. So has Bronx. And Bronx is absolutely convinced that Gregory here on this radio show is actually Anthony Krinsky.
Well, whether Gregory is Anthony or Darth Vader, let's hear what he has to say.
It doesn't matter. I've never lacked the balls to hide my identity.
I'm sorry, Gregory. I had to get that out. We only have, radio business. Don't worry, though. We have three minutes. Let me do this radio business. We have 3 minutes left live, but we will still have another half an hour after that. So go ahead.
I guess my question to the lady, and thank you for reading that paragraph. It was interesting. But I just want to go back to that. I mean, anyone, and I studied economics, anyone who has a rudimentary understanding of economics understands that generally the free market system works better than the public system.
Okay. No, I'm going to cut you out. Bye, Gregory. Sorry, pal.
Well, it's certainly more efficient.
No, the free market is more efficient. We do not have a free market in this country. We haven't had it ever. The free market is a lie. We don't even have it here.
Is there any country that you would consider having a free market?
No. Well, Somalia.
That says a lot. Okay. No, seriously, I think
Somalia.
How are their scores is what I want to know in Somalia.
Very, very bad.
Did you know that there are other ways to assess children's learning? It doesn't have to be by scores, and those other ways already exist in the schools now.
I do know that, Sahila, and I really support those things. I don't have any issue with that whatsoever. And, in fact, to be quite honest with you, in terms of, look, you all know, whether you believe it or not, my number one concern is not the teachers. It doesn't mean I don't care about them or care about their jobs or their professions at all.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm coming to this from a place of primary concern for students, all right?
Mm-hmm.
So
whatever
assessment tool that teachers can develop, and I would not ask anyone else to do it, to assess a child's beginning baseline at the beginning of a year and at the end, if that could be developed and used as an assessment tool. One,
we do.
To see whether
we have
the student learned.
We have
and
them.
Two, I'd like to see that become a part of the teacher's evaluation instead of the standardized test scores.
That's
already there.
That's what we've been doing forever. This new stuff comes from non-educators. When you were a kid, Mike, you took a pop quiz. That's an assessment. The teacher can use that to indicate to their boss how well you did. They'll show the pop quiz from the first week and the pop quiz from the last week. I mean, seriously, teaching is not rocket science. And I think that's one of the big problems here, is that big money has decided that they're going to make it sound like there's all kinds of science and data. It ain't that. Teaching is not rocket science. Teaching has very little to do with science at all. Teaching is an art. It's a social endeavor with kids. It requires a relationship. There's just no way you can determine anything by an end-of-the-year test. You can't determine how the kid did. You can't determine how good the teacher was. You can't determine any of that. So if you want to say that that's the measure we have and that's the measure we have to use, fine, say it. But at least also say that that's the measure we have and that's the measure we have to use, and it's completely bogus and erroneous, but we're stuck using it anyway. Because that would be the truth.
Can I jump
in
here real quick?
No, that's not how I would...
Sure.
You know what?
Speak,
can you guys
person.
Hear me?
Yeah, who are you?
Oh, hi, this is Dave.
Dave, my man. What's
hey,
up?
Hey, Dave.
Hi, guys.
Dave.
How's everybody tonight? Michael, how are you? Shayla, good to see you. Pete, thanks
good.
For having me on.
Sure,
hey, listen,
you've been on for a while. Sorry.
Yeah, well, no. You know what? I've been sitting and listening, and it's
you've
all been
good. You've been a great co-host, Dave.
Hey, it's been fun, man. I want to open this discussion up a little bit. You guys are talking about how the assessments and the scores are all done by people who are removed from the classroom and removed from education. I want to say that the entire system that education is operating under currently has all been designed by people far removed from the schoolroom and
mm-hmm.
far removed from the needs of kids. And this is why kids are dropping out in mass, is because
mm-hmm.
every teacher has a paradigm they have to operate under, a curriculum that's given by somebody, tests that are given by somebody, and it's not working for kids. And that's the fundamental thing that we need to address, I think, in my opinion.
Okay.
Agreed.
Respect that. Coming from
mm-hmm.
a teacher, I definitely respect that.
And I think that, you know, he makes such an important point, because from our perspective, this whole movement is... it precludes any of that. It's all coming from on high. It has nothing to do with the kids. It's all to make grown-ups who vote choose the right box in the voting booth.
That's right, and it's all done for political reasons. And it's, you know, the
yes,
whole propaganda thing nowadays that says that teachers are the root cause of student failure is absolutely
who says
bogus.
That?
A lot of people.
What organizations are saying that?
It's the complete message. Okay, if you go out there and you talk to anybody in the public and ask them why are kids failing, the major thing you're going to hear is it's all those shitty teachers that should go that are being protected by the unions. It's the backstory that's being laid out in piece by piece by piece. When people connect the dots in their superficial, idiotic ways that are misinformed and driven by propaganda, the conclusion they come to is it's those damn teachers, right? So as a teacher, I'm being vilified in the public. I've actually been to parties with old friends, and they've turned to me and said, you know what? It's all those bad teachers, man. You know what? Teachers just like they want to just get rid of all of them, like Reagan did with their traffic controllers, because it's their fault that our kids are failing. And then
and
we're in the situation. Pardon?
Those same politicians who put out those messages and those organizations who are in sync with the conservative or right-wing or ALEC kind of way of thinking of things are the same people that don't worry about poverty. Instead of
right.
putting funds into that, they blame it on the school system, which they intend to dismantle and take over, where profit will become the motive. When a business takes over schools, businesses are not about students. Businesses are about profits. The cheapest
right.
education they can provide to the student is more money in their pocket.
Absolutely.
It's not about children. And they
yeah,
use the naivete of the public to misunderstand test scores and the misuse of test scores. Why do you think they do high-stakes testing when there is absolutely no research that says it does a darn thing good for students? They
that's
can
right.
manipulate the high-stakes testing. That's why they like it. In the state of Florida, our governor and our commissioner recently ranked our districts based on a test score,
They did not include any other factor. So if you were a wealthy district, apparently you had the best teachers and the best school. This
no,
is
Diane, I agree. I agree. That is
and propagandistic.
Not fair. No, I agree with you, Diane. That is absolutely not fair. I mean, I know I don't have to be a teacher to know. I've invested enough time in studying up on this that the standardized test score alone tells an extremely limited picture that really can't be used for much of anything. So
let me tell you what the test scores can
them.
Be used.
That's all. Just leave student first. Start telling them that this is a bunch of baloney instead of saying, well, here's a good thing that student first does, or here's why I like it.
But Diane, I do. I've just recently, have you even liked the post?
Them.
Well,
but
just recently I have come out against this with them.
Okay, Diane, stop talking.
I'm sorry you haven't read it.
Sorry.
Mike keeps trying to answer you. Go, Mike.
No, I'm just saying that I have, in fact, come out numerous times directly to whoever's reading those threads about the fact that I would like them to answer the question. We all know what I'm talking about. I'd like to have them to answer the question of how can they have confidence in that? And frankly, the Gates editorial, backed by Reed, that they did not want the numbers made public, and I thought that was a bad idea, was extremely telling. I mean, if only a fool would not read between the lines on that.
Right.
So I do have a big issue with that with Students First, and I'm not shy about speaking.
We know
about
you
it.
Do. We will all stipulate that you have absolutely moved on your position because you have done the work that so many other people sort of refuse to do. And I absolutely commend you for that, without reservation.
Well, I appreciate that. And I mean, I appreciate the commendation, but it's just simply, you know, I don't do things to please a particular organization or what I do. Sometimes I do things to please my, you know, wife if I'm in trouble or something that I might not otherwise do. But other than that, you know, I'm not going to say, oh, I love BAM just because I like some of the other ideas that Students First has.
No,
I don't love it.
No, you're not that way. You're not a shallow guy. But I still can't get over the fact, it's because of your intelligence and the fact that you like good music. It's because of, you know, it's because of those really important attributes that I am just completely flummoxed. I don't understand why you don't see it the way I see it in terms of the Bobby Knight, Connie Chung thing. I mean, how can you give it anything? How come you aren't screaming at the top of your lungs, quit damaging, your kid's going to be taking it next year if he's not taking it this year already. You know,
he's going to be
stressing. I don't know if you read that blog post I did on, which, by the way, I just admitted was me. I did a whole blog post on the fact that a middle school kid, was sent to a test prep class because he got a low 3.
Right?
A low 3. My kid got a 3. That's proficient. My kid does great, but he was sent to test prep. And from that point until the present day, he's now worried that he's not good at tests. So the whole thing, not only is it uninformative and doesn't tell us anything, it damages actual children. It frightens them. It hurts them. I had little second graders in California that had to take that test, and I had to convince them that it was not about them. It was all about me, and I don't care how well you do. You can draw pictures on it. I don't care. It means nothing. And I was able to get a couple of the kids to be like, oh, okay, I guess it doesn't mean anything. But, you know, why put me and everybody through that? And the money, it does nothing for anybody. Mike,
dude,
God damn
I'm not
it,
saying that we
up.
Have to do that. You don't need to be flummoxed anymore.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean?
We have a young child on the call?
I think that's Eileen.
Sorry, not mine.
Is that Eileen's baby?
Yeah, it is, sir.
Gosh, but
God, I hate
that baby
that.
Be in test prep, Eileen.
What?
Shouldn't that baby be in test prep class right now? It's never too early.
She better be. She
I'll tell you what, on that note, Dave, the most important thing we can do, and Mike, you're going to agree with this, I know it, I think the
we'll
most
see.
Important thing we can do since
coming in a minute?
since Mike's point about poverty is sort of well taken, that nobody seems to want to do anything about it, since we're not going to do anything about poverty, but I'm going to still fight, we should definitely target preschool kids, and we should fund high-quality early childhood education. We should not be paying minimum wage to preschool teachers. We should fund preschool and pay actual teachers to work in them. What do you think?
That sounds like a good idea to me.
Cool.
Can I put a piece in there?
Please.
I would really like it if they don't decide that preschool is actually, you know, kindergarten brought forward a couple of years. Children's jobs, if you want to talk about jobs, is
yes.
to learn through play.
Yes.
And I've been seeing rather worrying ideas being passed around the place that there ought to be a curriculum for preschoolers and there ought to be testing for preschoolers.
Right.
And
I'm not talking about that.
I just find that horrible.
I do too, and I do not mean that. What I mean is something like my mom, who is pushing 80 years old, was a singer. She was kind of showbiz. She's a great mom, obviously. And now in her old age, she is a nanny. She lives up in Portland,
mm-hmm.
and she nannies. And I watch her with these little kids, and it just reminds me of, you know, what she was like with me. And she's patient, and she sings, and she sits down and points things out, and she nurtures your curiosity, and all the things a good grandma is supposed to do, right? So how about we staff these preschools with some old grandmas? And I'm serious. I can tell you right now that there are thousands, if not millions, of retired teachers who maybe couldn't handle all the bending over, so you'd have to have a couple of, you know, younger bodies in there. But get some of these retired teachers that are just grandmas and grandpas now and get them in the preschools and let them read to the kids and sing with them and bring in their instruments. And, you know, they're retired. They have a little money. They'll bring in their camera. They'll do, you know, since we're not going to fund things as a society, these are silly little ideas that pop into my head. What do you think?
The part that I really like about that is that, you know, there's this whole thing about it takes a village to raise a child, and our kids are stuck in these factories where they don't get to connect with the outside world, where they don't get to connect with multiple generations,
right.
Especially, you know, and they're growing up in this artificial environment. And I really think that half of their trouble comes, you know, in terms of moving from adolescence into adulthood, comes because they've not been let out into the real world and they don't get in any interaction with kids that are younger than them, whom they can, you know, they can be mentors and role models for, and they don't get access to the wisdom of the elders with the way our world is. And I think that what you're suggesting is an amazing idea. Not, you know, people will get, youngsters will get access to different cultural ideas, they'll get access to different skills and talents that these older people have, that they've got access to wisdom that you don't get out of a book. You do
right.
not get in a curriculum.
No, I agree with you. I think that's, I mean, again, I hate to rely on common sense since I just critiqued it with the LIFO discussion, but it is common sense that that's how kids learn. And so I want to give you guys like just a short, happy, hopefully, although you'll probably find a way to be unhappy about it, no offense, but a short, happy story. You know, in Chicago, most, if not all, but most of our public school students for years have not had recess. Or if they've had it, it has been 10 minutes like Monday and, you know, Thursday. And a lot of the schools do not even have a playground. With the, aside from all the other, you know, discussions there may be, and I don't know how up you guys are on the full day, the longer day discussion in Chicago schools. You may not be, you don't live here, but it's been a real big deal, a very big deal. All the schools are moving to add 90 minutes to their schedules next year. And the happy part of this is, as it relates to our discussion, there's so much press coming out from the individual schools and principals and CPS that recess is being reinserted into the curriculum of pretty much every school. A longer lunch period. At my kids' school, half the time they're not even allowed to talk
during lunch.
How long is the day now, and how long? Just how long is the day?
The day will be 7.5 hours, and now it's a little over 6, I believe, on average.
Okay, because I think we were 7.5. Well, no, we were 7.
Seven and a half is, at least according to the data, the comparisons I've seen, and again, you know, I trust what I have no reason to not trust, but that Chicago had the shortest school day and the shortest school year of any of the top 10 largest urban districts. So this brings us.
Finland
current,
is shorter.
I know, but we don't live in Finland.
So I'm just saying, longer days and longer years don't do a damn thing for anybody.
No,
right, but we don't
live
in Finland. We're in a completely different in every single way. So it's not.
No. I'm saying. If you had lengthened my day during my 13 years in the classroom, nothing more would have been done. That wouldn't have helped anybody. That would have made more tired kids who fell asleep for more of the class time than they did.
Okay, so you feel that most of the rest of the top 10 urban districts, which are already around that time, that their kids are tired and. So they should have a shortened day?
I know.
We're just trying to get equal. We're not trying to be the world leader.
Yeah, no, I know they're tired. Kids, you know, as long as there's recess and lunch and time to play, kids can handle a little more time. So I'm not necessarily saying what Chicago's doing is a bad idea. I'm just saying that longer academic time, at least for young kids, is baloney.
I'd just like to put in... This is, you know, an old-timer here thing. Thinking back when I went to school in New Zealand, we had a 6.5-hour day. And we had an hour for lunch, and we had a morning and an afternoon recess of 15 minutes each. And my point is that in all that 6.5 hours of academics, wasn't straight academics. We had drama, we had PE, we had music. We had speaking and all of those things. And
when I was a kid.
Ed reformers would look at that as not learning because it doesn't fall within very, you know, very tight criteria of a subject, like sitting down to do language arts or whatever. But the point is that all that learning travels across all those different subjects. It's all interrelated.
Right.
Math is
totally
part of
agree.
Art. Music is part of math.
Right.
You know,
absolutely.
Learning to recite a poem as a class out of the, you know, some 16th century poem, and then getting the history of
the poet and the history
of those times.
Let me jump in and get all teachy on you. What you're talking about, Sahila, is background knowledge, and impoverished kids lack background knowledge, which is why they show up in kindergarten not knowing, not able to recognize a letter or know what sound it makes, when all of our kids, before they ever started kindergarten, were probably even creatively spelling. They knew all their colors, all their letters, all their sounds. So background knowledge is what preschools provide. Background knowledge is what play provides. I do have a degree in developmental psychology.
Can you guys get behind a program that will bring back all of those other subjects to the classroom for all the students in this district? I mean, I don't mean physically, will you actually get behind it, but, you know, in theory,
hell yes.
That's what's happening. You know,
practice, that's what we're trying to do. Mike,
right.
That's what we're trying to do, you know, by saying that NCLB was wrong and Race to the Top is wrong and standardized testing is wrong. What we're also saying is that children learn through play.
Right.
They don't learn through sitting there doing the same thing day after day after day. They don't go by the curriculum that's out there. School used to be what we remember it to be, what Sahila was talking about. School used to be where you'd go and you'd have fun and you'd create stuff and you'd come home smarter and wiser and know more about the world around you. That doesn't happen anymore, you know?
Well,
some schools, but most don't. The affluent
schools still do, Mike.
Yeah, that's what Malia and Sasha get at whatever their school is called. You know, they still get that stuff. But most kids in this country...
Sasha and Malia, Obama's daughters, where do
they go to school? Sidwell Friends.
My point is, why is the government, why are these billionaires, why are whoever is
funding all of this ed reform, why do they not want that, and why do they not commit to giving that to every single child in this country?
Exactly,
because
and that's our fight.
That will, the reason why they
because
don't
it's
is
not
that will lead to, but it leads to student success, and they don't want that because student success
oh,
takes away
on,
their opportunity.
On, Dave.
No, Dave. You don't think so? You don't, Mark,
dude. But that to me
argument.
Is like part of the grand conspiracy theory. That all these
no,
people
it,
are really doing this, one, to make only to make money, and two, to actually not help them, but the exact opposite, to further screw the kids who are already screwed the most. I just don't buy it. I just don't buy it.
Well,
I mean,
we, you have
opinion,
to. You,
I just won't share it.
Okay, here's just historically speaking, and who's to say that it still does exist today, but historically speaking, our school system was indeed created not to educate
mm-hmm.
anyone, but to make compliant workers. Now, we knew that, and we've known that for a long time, and over the past decades, we've gone to a more sort of lefty, left-leaning, let's make school a good place for kids and help them to learn, and then with immigration, we've had to teach tolerance and all these things that are good about the public schools. But to say that there aren't still some oligarchs out there who would be perfectly happy to see to it that we don't have an educated population, that is not an impossibility. I mean, you do know, Mike, that
I'm not saying it's an impossibility.
Well, it's not even not just an impossibility. I mean, we do censor. We have big money that lobbies and pays for all kinds of things that the rest of us don't get, and they pay to keep certain information out of your view, you know.
Yep, we all know who the heavy hitters are in lobbying. We've been over that, but you're
right.
Many organizations do.
And so to claim, like it sounds like you're claiming, that none of this has any nefarious aspect to it at all is naive.
No, I just said I don't buy into the grand conspiracy theory as I thought Dave had laid it out just now.
Well, I think what...
Well, I'm not saying that there are... Dude, of course there are people who in power here and in every other country in the world now and throughout the past history who are only in it to make money and don't give a shit about what happens to anybody who gets in their way. I would never say
that. And isn't that fundamentally wrong? In education, isn't that fundamentally wrong? It's immoral.
Sure. It is immoral.
It gets in the way of student learning. And we've seen it by the fact that they've watered down the textbooks. You know, earlier tonight you were talking about how, you know, people are saying they shouldn't make money on education. But now you say that the profit-taking at the expense of student learning is immoral. But we're seeing it. We're seeing,
That's not what I said. Well, first of all, whether or not somebody is making money is secondary of concern to me to whether or not the students are getting whatever we consider, quote-unquote, a quality and good education.
And that's being measured by bonus tests.
If someone opened up a school, and every kid, a public school, every kid that went there, nobody got kicked out, nobody was creamed, they took all comers, and the school was excelling through whatever mechanism. At the same time, the people who ran the school were making a shit ton of money. Do you guys have a problem with it?
Yeah,
well,
I do.
It wouldn't be public if that were happening. So
no, I'm asking you to use your imagination here.
Well,
okay,
I can't imagine.
I think that's a good question.
Yeah, and I can't imagine a public school making money, but I can imagine a private school making money, and there's lots of them that do, and they do it by creaming students and getting rich people to send their kids there.
Here's the problem that I have with that scenario, Mike, is that if school X is serving the needs of 100 students and making $1 million, how many times could they duplicate their system with that $1 million instead of being profit-driven, be student-driven, and replicate
mm-hmm.
themselves using that money?
Sure, I think that's mm-hmm. a legitimate question to ask.
Well,
yeah,
but what we have in this country is a public school system, and education is compulsory, so everyone has to go to school. Those that have money can choose a private school. We already have choices out there for people that can afford them and want them. What we don't have is that same choice in our traditional public schools because we as a society refuse to fund them, so they'll never be as good as those other schools. Except that that's not really true either, because those other schools aren't really good so much as they have good students. So
right.
When, you know, it's all of a
piece. What about the 90-90-90 schools?
That was debunked and nonsense. That's all just nonsense. My principal tried to get us to get on that band, dude, because it's bullshit. Because you are not going to have
not an answer.
It didn't work. They lied. The data was bullshit. It was pure, unadulterated bullshit. Like Jeffrey Canada's Harlem Children's Zone, when he claims 100% graduation rate, that's bullshit. Because he doesn't tell you he kicks out an entire class.
He kicked out a whole grade
he kicked out. And then there's that other jerk, Dr. What's his name, the CNN guy who runs his charter school academy. He also kicks kids out and refuses to admit it. And CNN's going to boot his ass very soon.
Public schools kick kids out, too.
Public schools do. No, they do not. They kick kids out only when ed code has been violated. You don't get to kick kids out for low performance. You don't get to kick kids out because they're an ELL kid. You don't get to kick them out because they have a special need. In fact, the charters won't take the special needs kids. So now what we have is a situation where not only do public schools have the brains sucked out of them and sent to the charters, but now they have even more special needs kids because the charters refuse to take them.
Yeah, no, that's an area where the charters need to step up to the plate. I agree.
Why, instead of saying and, that, Mike, why don't you just say that that's another bit of evidence that charters are harming what used to be a decent public education system? Why can't you go there?
Because I don't believe that.
You
don't believe that.
But everything you're saying points to the fact that you do actually believe that.
I think charters could do better with special needs than ELL.
Well, and which is an admission that
they shouldn't exist.
Which is an admission that they don't do well.
But there's a lot of examples I can come up with where I could say, yes, I support this organization, or I support this idea, but I don't like this part of it.
What part of the charter?
In your world, it's just black and white for you.
No, what part of the charter do you like? So far, you've given me no reason, you've given me no indication that there's anything about a charter that you like.
I like the fact that there is a choice.
It's a false choice, though, right? Because the propaganda that the charters push is basically full of lies. They say they have a new special pedagogy, blah blah blah, all that stuff that absolutely is not true.
Well,
there's
studies, there's meta-analyses, and that they are outperforming in some areas. I've never said that they're the panacea. They're a part.
You keep saying that there are studies that show they're doing something. No, the studies show that they don't do anything.
Trial Urban District something or other that showed that they made larger gains in their public school counterparts. That's a NAEP study. I don't remember exactly what year it was, but
Mike, here's the thing.
Analysis on them.
No, but you're missing. I think you're missing the point. All of the test scores that are being used are meaningless, yet you're basing your love of certain charters on test scores. But what I'm telling you is those test scores don't reflect teaching. Test scores reflect socioeconomic status. That's what the disaggregated NAEP shows. That's what the disaggregated PISA shows. That's the reason value added doesn't work, because you cannot measure a variable that varies so much. There's no way to control for any of this. So when you say that there are studies that show some charter schools do better, that's based on nonsense. It's based on bogus
test
scores.
Well, it's based on, again, what we discussed half hour ago. It's based on what we currently use as accepted measuring stick.
Which you admit
is bogus. I'm not saying that it's accurate or it isn't, but it's all that we have.
Right. So you're basing your – you're saying that there are charters that do well, and you're basing that on values that you deem inaccurate.
I don't know what else to assess them on.
Well, you'd really, something.
You won't
other
use
than,
their scores. You won't use their graduation rate.
Mike, how can I use something that is inaccurate? Should I use a thermometer to measure how tall you are?
How are you
possibly going to make any statement of truth about how good or bad a school is?
How can we make any statement of truth about anything?
Well, you're saying we literally have
no idea how any school is performing because this tool is what you're saying?
No, I am saying that, in a way, yes, I'm saying if we are using that tool to determine how good or bad a school is, since that tool is flawed, we don't know. But if we were to look at portfolios of students and take the other kinds of assessments that actually show what kind of progress a child makes and then use that data somehow, that would be a more accurate way to show whether or not there is anything good going on in the classroom. But the other thing
I would love that, Rich. I don't have any problem with that.
Then you got to fight with us for it. And what that will mean is that there will, and you might not like this part. And this is where I think I don't want to say confused, but I can't think of the right word right now.
I know you think I'm confused, but that's okay.
Realize that the if we use portfolios and all these other things, we're still going to be ranking schools. And in the big, wide world out there, ranking a school doesn't do anything for the kids. If all you care about is the kids, and I believe that's where you're coming from and it's where we're all coming from, ranking schools hurts children because when a child suddenly finds out they're going to a low-ranked school, they suddenly become low-ranked themselves. We should not be ranking schools. There's no reason to rank them. Well, hold on. Let me finish. We don't have to. And why I say we don't have to is because if we were to fund our public schools better, we would have very little to worry about because we would have high-quality people. Not that we don't now. It's a misnomer that we don't now. Teachers are highly educated people, highly competent people, some of the most competent people out there. But if we paid teachers more and we funded schools better, there's not one parent here on earth that would have anything bad to say about their school. I think you make a lot of generalizations
that you put a lot of weight behind, and I think that's a mistake that you make a lot of times, Rich. Respectfully said.
Can I put something in there? I'd like to put something in there. There's a discussion that we've been having on and off in Seattle for about two years now on the Save Seattle Schools blog, and it has been about talking about failing schools. And there are several teachers whose opinions whose expertise and whose teaching skills I stand in awe of, who make the point that there are no failing schools. What you have happening as classrooms with children who are coping or excelling or not doing well with aspects of school and aspects of learning. And in some schools, you have a higher ratio of those in the school than other schools do. The schools and the teachers are doing the best they can with what they've got. They can't control the variables that come into that classroom. So to actually label a school as failing is just such a misnomer. It's a school that has a higher ratio of problems.
Yep. I do not disagree. Mike, my generalizations are from my decades of experience working with kids and in public schools. They're not just generalizations. They're my expertise. So I'd like to know. I'm prefacing something. So what generalizations did I make that you think are not accurate?
Well, but Rich, you know, I'm very regularly point out when I think you're making a generalization. I mean, I can't list all the more times I thought I just made one.
Didn't I just make one and you called me on it?
If we funded schools to whatever level that you feel would be appropriate and had a credentialed teacher in every class that you said, no, not a single parent would have any issue with their school.
And I think the generalizations like who knows, it was a minor thing. We don't need to get sidetracked.
Well, here's okay.
But let me just ask you guys, I'm going to have to depart. Understood. I'm going to have to depart in not too long. It's 11 o'clock where I am. But, you know, look, I'm not interested in pitting one school against another. And I also don't think that ranking and grading schools based on the tool that we now have, which we've all agreed, is essentially invalid for the purpose. However, I feel, and, you know, I know I'm not a teacher, but call me crazy. I am a person who deals with numbers. I am a person who deals with, I'm the director of quality improvement, so that's what I do. So I do have some familiarity with it, and that's why I believe that there can be a way that we can find, we're either going to find it or we're not, but I think we can find a way to assess student performance in a way that doesn't necessarily put high-stakes testing, fear, and everything into schools, into students and teachers, but still gives us an idea, did the teacher make some sort of impact? I understand that the tool must take into account, in some way, these other factors that happen outside of the school.
Let me ask you
guys
this.
Have told me, it's I believe it 100%.
What if
I know
teacher,
the effects of poverty.
I hear you. What
but
if
there's
the got to
be a way to measure Mike, and include that.
Mike, what if the kid made no progress? Are you sure that's the teacher's fault?
No.
So what end do you want this? What are you hoping to glean from some high-quality teacher assessment? I mean, if you just now admitted that if a student makes no progress, that might have nothing to do with the teacher, what is the point of all this teacher testing? I mean, don't we weed out, don't we first make teachers apply to a program, pass the program, pass certain credentialing tests and milestones before they can get their credential? I mean, isn't that how we assure that we have a decent teacher? That's how we do it with doctors and lawyers and every other profession that I can think of. There are hoops you jump mm-hmm. through to become that professional. And once you've jumped through those hoops, you are that professional. And only until you are slammed with a malpractice suit or something do you.
You are, but that doesn't mean that because, again, this is an assumption or a generality. If you went through the hoops, if you did what you're supposed to do and you got all the credentials that we say you need to do this job, it's irrational to me to then say, because you've done all this and we put great faith in our vetting process of
but we don't do it with anyone else.
Or whatever.
But can I jump in here real quick, guys?
You never have to, you know, be... Go ahead.
We're missing something very fundamental, okay? If teachers are professionals, this system does not honor that in the least bit. In Japan, the teachers engage in lesson study. They take a look to see what their students and their schools need. They develop lessons. They learn about that. It's an ongoing process that goes on year after year after year. The teachers are the ones who are empowered to do what is necessary for their kids in that school. It's not a top-down mm-hmm. mandate. And that's what we're missing in this country is the fact that we are saying the system doesn't trust teachers. That's why we have NCLB in the first place. That's why we have high stakes testing. It's because we don't believe that the teachers are capable of understanding their students and doing what's necessary. So we've taken all that option, we've taken all that choice away from the teachers, and we've told them what to do, and it's a dismal failure.
Well, I agree, Dave.
I'm living in a household with a kindergarten teacher right now, and she's qualified. She's highly qualified. She teaches a general a classroom that is integrated. She has general kids as well as special ed kids, and she's a kindergarten teacher, and I watch her every day prepare and do professional development and adjust what she's learning and what she's teaching to each of those children's needs. You know, she's leaving home at 6:45 in the morning, and she's not getting home with meetings and professional development and that till about 9 o'clock at night. And she's got
half her class has got
IEPs, individual education plans, and she is mm-hmm. working her ass off to meet the needs of those kids. And I'm saying that we already have systems in place for teachers to keep on top of, you know, professional development and the latest things in neuroscience and all of those all of those things that help them to do their job better. And we already have evaluations of teachers in place. She just had yesterday, on Monday, she had a pre-evaluation session with her principal, and yesterday she had the evaluation of how she teaches math to her kindergartners. And this is her second evaluation in the 4 months that we've been living with her. So I'm saying that all of these checks and balances are already in the system. Perhaps they're not being used the way they ought to be in some areas, and yes, teachers or people who ought not to be teachers are there longer than they need to be, but that's a system failure. It's not a professional failure.
Right. I'm not saying that it is. I'm not saying that. I agree. It's a systems failure. I think you're right about that.
Cool.
Yeah, and that goes back into that whole tenure and last in first out thing. If the system is doing its job properly, people who really are not equipped to be good teachers ought not to be there after the first 3 or 4 years if the system is doing its job properly, which means that by the time a teacher is into their third or fourth year, they are they're a good teacher. So then when it is layoff time because it's a budget issue, theoretically we have all good teachers in the classroom if the system's doing its job properly. So
right.
How do you decide which one must go?
Right.
And the whole thing is, if you already know which ones are not,
you lay off the least effective one. That's just so easy for me.
No, we don't know. What she's saying is the new ones...
I completely misunderstood it.
The new ones are not as good as the veterans.
Exactly. The veterans
have the experience.
They've got the skill level, they're master teachers, pretty much, and why would anybody want to get rid of a master teacher with all that institutional knowledge, a huge value to any enterprise, whether it's a school or a business?
Yeah, you know, I just had an insight into what Mike's saying. I totally hear what you're saying. You're saying that... let's assume, given a school has all veteran teachers in it, what Mike is saying is that if that school suffers a budget crisis and has to fire or lay off some people, and they're all veterans, all of them, all 5 years, between 5 and 30 years, let's say, Mike is saying that if we have to lay off teachers, we should go ahead and look at the ones who are best and who are worse and lay off the worst ones. What I think Sahila is saying and what I'm saying and where we differ with you, Mike, is that given that same scenario, all those teachers are veterans and considered good teachers.
Hold on.
They may vary year to year, but they're going to vary year to year because their classroom full of kids varies from year to year. So the fairest way to eliminate people who are equal is by time served. Because the assumption is that veterans are good. That's why they're veterans. They've been able to stay and do well long enough. So,
and in a scenario where every teacher from 5 to 30 years, if I felt confident that the...
here's the thing. It's not about how you feel.
You guys are snickering, but let me finish. If I felt confident that the assessment, whatever it was based on, if I had a confidence, meaning I'm the principal, whoever, you know, not a parent, if I felt confident that the assessment that we were using was meaningful, that we in our school, our district, whatever, agreed that it was an effective and fair way to judge people, if that were in place and there was confidence it was there, and then the range of 5 to 30-year teachers were all graded, you know, A, let's say, at that point, absolutely, I would say, look, you're all equal, you're all great. We have no way to determine who's better or worse in the classroom because we think you're all great based on this assessment that we all agree works. Therefore, the earliest, the first in go, and the people who've been here longer get to stay. Under that scenario, I think that's entirely fair.
I just want to be sure
that they're, well,
that is
I don't know what it
now.
Is.
Well, that's why... I call you a teacher basher. Because I think deep down somewhere, Mike, you lack confidence in America's teachers. Otherwise, you wouldn't be saying this stuff.
No, that is a retort, Rich, that is laden and dripping with emotion, and it gets right to the most emotional part of this whole thing. And so when you say
I'm
that,
very unemotional
like
about
people,
it.
People, well, you may be, but I think you know what I'm talking about. That's where the passion lies.
But
whether
that's why
or not
we're here.
It's all because
to talk about this dispassionately.
So,
are you honestly telling me that you have complete confidence in America's teachers?
Do I have complete confidence? I don't know that I have complete confidence in anything.
Do you have a lack
have a
of
great...
confidence? Tell me the
no,
truth, Mike.
I don't think I do. No, I'm happy to tell you the truth. I've been telling you the truth for over a year. I don't have a lack of confidence in our teaching corps as it stands now. No, I don't.
So
but that
what
doesn't
is...
mean that I don't want to insist that we have a way to know.
But we
saying I don't have a lack
way.
Of confidence doesn't mean that I'm saying I think they're all great.
No, I know,
I
but I keep telling you that there is no way to rate teachers because different teachers operate differently with different. It's like rating oncologists or rating pediatricians. You know, certain parents don't like their pediatrician because who knows why, a personality conflict. You just you cannot measure the thing you're trying to measure, which is why professionals typically are not measured that way because it's an impossibility. You cannot measure how well someone does with your kid. I may do great with your kid in second grade, but the third grade teacher may have a personality conflict, which is why I also say that teachers and students should be free in the first couple of weeks of school to actually deal with those personality conflicts.
Yep.
Yeah, and let kids switch out and be open about it and be cool about it. There's nothing wrong with that. It's real life.
No, I
know
appreciate your position. And I'm not going to say, I think you'll say it to me, but I'm not going to say to you, I think and I know that, you know, you're wrong. You may be right. But my belief, and it's shared by a whole lot of people, is that there, and remember, I am in statistical measurement. That is kind of what I do. So that's why I believe that there is a way to develop something that is a lot more fair than what we
all
have.
Right, I'll
so
tell you
give
what,
us good insight.
How about as soon as that's developed, they put it out and let us take a look at it. But until then, since nothing like that exists, and I doubt it ever will, but until that thing you want exists based on your knowledge of statistics and numbers, and since you know it can exist, let's wait for it. Don't you think that makes sense? I mean, if it exists...
I think that probably makes more sense than pushing more of the VAM models. Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
But
so,
I'm not willing to be that complacent, I guess. I just...
Well, wait, but what do you think... In what way does holding... Does any of this accountability nonsense help the kids? We've just all agreed that it doesn't help the kids. I mean,
as a
current
stance.
Right.
One thing that I heard the other day that really rang with me is this, that, and this is kind of what Sahila said earlier, there are no failing schools. What it's a measure of is a whole bunch of kids that got failing grades.
Right.
Okay? And that's how they measure that. So if, you know, if this school is below average, you got kids that year after year after year are told, you don't do it. And that's coming down from on high. And these kids look to authority. And if for no other reason, I think that we need to adjust it for just that, you know,
right.
Because these kids are going year after year feeling like failures, and that's why they drop out by the drove.
Right, and it's not true. They're not failures. I mean, given that we can, give me a map.
They just
and,
need better teachers.
And give me
kidding,
and
kidding,
give me,
kidding.
I know. And give me a map with zip, you know, by zip code, and show me the impoverished zip codes, and I'll tell you their score. Give me the...
No, I'm not going to dispute that.
So that's all...
You're right.
That's kind of all you need to know about this reform movement. Until we deal with that reality, until we make it so that Teacher Rich cannot look at a map and predict accurately your score.
Well, yeah, I mean, Rich, that's just a difference of opinion, my friend. You know, I don't see how you can say I'm absolutely right, and I certainly know that I can't say I'm absolutely right. It's a difference of opinion, and we see, I certainly acknowledge that you've been in the classroom, you guys all have, and I haven't, but
I haven't.
Nevertheless, you haven't. Okay, fair enough. But since you haven't been in the classroom, but since your opinions jive with theirs, you don't get the same kind of comments. I think that's pretty clear. But at any rate, well, guys, look, I do need to sign off. Unfortunately,
let me do the official. Let me do the official.
It's been
thank
really
you.
Cool. Yeah, it's been really cool talking to you.
The feeling is mutual. As I told you, Sahila, I have a Kiwi brother-in-law, so I love your accent.
Thank you. I do too, Sahila. Yeah, it's beautiful.
At some point, Sahila's gonna do me a voiceover for my radio intro, right?
Uh-huh. Sahila,
you said you were gonna do that. All right.
I found the webcam and mic the other day.
Okay, well, I'm gonna cut everybody off and say goodbye. Let me just thank everybody that was in the chat room and everybody that called in and participated. Let me apologize to those that I didn't get to. Dave, Sahila, Diane, Mike, don't know how to thank you, Mike. I really, really appreciate this. You're a mensch. So there you go. Peace out, everybody.
It's a privilege, guys. I enjoyed
right.
it, too, everybody.
Nice.
Take care.
Good night, everybody. Good night.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Bye.
Good night. Good night, John Boy. All right, so it's just me left. Looks like I have about 8 minutes. So let me just say a couple of things. Number one, Bronx called in, and I didn't get to him, and I think he hung up angry, and I'm sorry. I don't know if he was angry with me or angry with the conversation, but I am sorry. I told you to call back, and you didn't. I think you were just sick of the nonsense. Stu, you were in the chat room. You were listening in the beginning. And I told you to call in, and you wouldn't, and you thought I was giving you a hard time. No, sir. I just wanted you to call in. I want you to take care of your baby more than I want you to call in. Trust me. So, Mike said he'd be happy to do this again. It was good to have Dave Russell back on. That was who chimed in towards the end there with that sort of baritone voice. Sahila, always a pleasure to have her. I love listening to Sahila talk. Not because of her accent, although I love that too, but she is just, she cuts to the meat. She cares about people. That's who Sahila is. Sahila cares about people other than her and her own. And I think that that's what we all need to do. That's what I think we on the anti-reform side are trying to do. We're trying to express our concern for the least among us, our impoverished kids who suffer the most with all this nonsense. I must say that Mike is a great guest to have, incredibly respectful, articulate, smart as hell. And he agrees with a lot of stuff, but he's not willing to put his foot down and say something is so. When I am, and I, you know, maybe he's right. Maybe I shouldn't be so emphatic. I don't know. Maybe. Nah, I think I should be emphatic. I think, given my experience with kids and in the classroom, there are a few things I actually do know for sure. And I know that the whole testing regime and value-added measurement and longer days, I know all of that is bad for kids. I was going to say earlier that I do have a master's in developmental psychology because I was interested, not that it does me any good. But what Sahila was saying about kids learning through play is not just true for kids, really. I mean, if you want to get down to it, our brains are wired to learn. We are curious by biology. We need to satisfy our curiosity. That's why that phrase exists. Satisfy our curiosity. Because our curiosity is sort of biological. We need to satisfy it. We need to satiate it, like hunger. And kids are pure, unadulterated curiosity. So that's what they do. They follow whatever they're curious about. When your kid was little and you were on your walk and your little 2-year-old stopped to look at that fuzzy caterpillar, you didn't say, come on, come on, I want you to study these letters. No, you sat down, you put the little brakes on your stroller, and you asked questions, you talked about it, you asked, what do you see? What do you think it's doing? That's teaching. Good parents like that I just described are teaching. That is teaching. And that's watching your child do that is watching your child learn. That is literally what is going on. Learning. You only learn what you want to learn. When you get older and you have to learn something, I suppose you've by that time honed the skills required to sit down and study something and put it into your brain. But when you were young, that's not necessarily how you did it. You did it by what you were excited about and what interested you. You need to follow your bliss as a kid to a point. So when Sahila talks about play and Mike talks about bringing recess back to Chicago Public Schools, bringing recess back to Chicago Public Schools is absolutely crucial because of what Sahila said about play. Without play, kids don't learn. In school, recess has another feature, which is socialization. Kids need a chance to socialize. They need a chance to practice their social skills. They need to use them. In fact, when you go to the doctor's office, you're going to their medical practice. And it's called a practice because you practice it. You're always getting better, which, by the way, has to do with veteran teachers now, doesn't it? So, kids need to play. Teachers need to be free to satiate or satisfy a child's curiosity. They can't do that with a scripted curriculum. They can't do that with a mandated curriculum. They can't do that when they have to worry about what the principal's going to come in and see up on the wall or see what the teacher actually happens to be doing. There were many times when my principal walked in and I had kids all over desks and laying on the floor, and some of them were screaming. You know why? They were having a frickin' blast. And I don't know what they were. Maybe we were learning about continents or oceans or the water cycle. Remember, this is second grade, so. You know, I don't know what we were learning about. Who cares? Really, because the adding and the subtracting and the punctuation and the periods, that doesn't come with learning the algorithm and write down what I say. No, that comes with being interested in something and then me somehow getting you to want to maybe write about it. And then I can help you with your punctuation and your spelling and stuff. But that's secondary, see? I don't care so much about, I want you to get your idea on the paper. I want you to feel what you're saying, and I want you to feel it and write it down. And if you write it down and you spell it wrong or you punctuate it badly, isn't that how we all write on our word processors now, for God's sakes? And then we go back and edit it? Come on, people. Let kids do their thing. Let them be the kids that they are. That's how they will turn out to be good adults. Our most impoverished kids get very little as babies. They get very, very little. They have no background knowledge. They don't learn colors and letters. People don't talk to them. That's what good teachers do. Good teachers expand the world. They provide background knowledge for children. In my classrooms, in the district where I worked, I had almost always had a good mix of the affluent and the way below poverty. And the mix of kids in a classroom is hugely important. I can tell you there were many times when one of my students who would score 100% on everything, she didn't need me to give her more curricular crap. She needed me to find something special. And I did, but that wasn't what I was supposed to do. And I can't tell you how many times my impoverished kids that don't have that kind of background knowledge have another kind of knowledge that the rest of us can learn from. They were incredibly valuable as human beings in my class. My classroom was a community because that's how human beings operate. So, thank you all for listening and listening to this last 10 minutes of diatribe, but the kids are important. It's for the kids. Peace out. Thank you. Bye-bye.